Let's see how many come in the first 10 minutes of this lecture.
Today what I want to do is to, in a way, broaden out the discussion from last time, which had to do with this business of the science wars that I was talking about, and the science wars having to do with the new questions that have arisen about the status of science and society in light of the end of the Cold War. And during the Cold War, support of science was kind of unquestioned, largely because it was seen as a bulwark of national security. And to a large extent, behind-the-scenes warfare, because actually there wasn't all that much outright conflict during the Cold War except for the Vietnam War, that the prevention of conflict now on a more global scale between the U.S. and the USSR had a lot to do with intelligence and counterintelligence and all kinds of sophisticated technologies that were developed to anticipate and intercept missiles and so forth. And you probably know about all this, if not through reading history, through the movies and so forth. And all of this required quite a lot of strong input of the physics community in particular. And they and the computer science community were the biggest beneficiaries of this state funding of science during the Cold War. But with the end of the Cold War, with the end of the Cold War, this has in fact shifted, and now the whole justification for funding science at a state level is open. And so what that means is that if the state's going to fund science, they have to know more directly who's going to benefit from it. And so that means that science has to kind of pitch its argument for justifying funding at a more individual, consumer, client-driven level. And this is why there's been this shift in funding patterns from the physical sciences to the biomedical sciences over the past 20 years. And we're seeing this increasing even now. Now, one of the consequences of that, when you start to think about science as something that needs to be justified at the level of the benefits it provides fairly directly to people, that you end up with the situation of science kind of losing its focus, losing any sense of a unitary direction in which it's going. And as you know, when we traditionally talked about progress as an idea, the idea of social progress, typically the motor or engine of social progress was scientific progress. And that presupposed the idea that there's some kind of linear way in which science kind of increases the production of knowledge and we get closer and closer to the truth or something of that kind. Okay? And the idea was that science kind of moved all in one direction so that to improve things in one science is in principle to improve things in other sciences. Now, they all sort of move together. They're all serving this kind of common purpose of humanity. And this is one of the things that made it very easy to justify the state as being the primary funder of science, because the state, in a way, is the guarantor, at least in the modern era, of the well-being of people in general in this society. Right? The state, you know, this is where welfare provision and so forth, education, health, all this kind of stuff, national security even, right, comes into play. The state, as it were, assumes the role of guarantor for the well-being of the people in the society. And so under those circumstances, science is seen as the thing that's going to increase that, and so there's funding for science. But what happens now that science is kind of moving in multiple directions? Right, in a sense, the state is receding from its funding, or at least it's receding in terms of the direction that it gives. It's willing to say, we'll put some money in, but we're only going to put money into things that other people already find important. Okay, so this guy who spoke on Monday, Gary Lynch, okay, he's a professor of neuropsychiatry at the University of California, Irvine. Okay, so he's an academic. He also has startup companies in pharmaceutical companies, right, that produce drugs that can, in fact, enhance your memory capacity based on the research he's done about how memories are produced and stored in neurons. Okay, this is quite a common thing. And what you know, with research of this kind, typically, and he said this actually in the beginning of his talk, right, he gets money from the National Institute of Health, which is a state-run body in the United States, the main medical funding body in the United States. He gets money from those guys, right, but the money is also matched by corporate money. Now, for various accounting reasons, those monies may go into different accounts and so forth. So one goes into the company and the other goes into the lab and the department. Okay, but the point is these monies follow each other. They track each other. He wouldn't be able to get money from one source if he wasn't getting money from the other source. So the point here is the government isn't actually setting the priorities for science in some kind of unified fashion, but rather the government is complementing, right, directions that the science is going, given market conditions, right? Given what sells, in other words. So that's the difference. So when we talk about the state receding from science policy in the era we're in, the so-called postmodern era, it's not that the state doesn't fund science anymore, but rather the state doesn't have, as it were, an overarching agenda on behalf of people as a whole, but rather is kind of following what the market says. So the state funds a lot in the biomedical field because the pharmaceutical companies are interested in funding the research. Okay, but not because there's some kind of independent reason. Okay, see, the thing about national security in the Cold War that made it so attractive as a basis for the state to fund science was that issues of national security, like whether the United States is going to be hit by a nuclear bomb from Russia, which is what people were worried about back then, that this issue affects everyone regardless of their consumer interests. Right? Regardless of whether you have Alzheimer's or arthritis or whatever, right? The point is, if the Russians send a nuclear bomb and bomb New York, there goes the country. So the state has, you know, so part of the general welfare functions of the state are incorporated by funding research that can anticipate and potentially offset any nuclear attacks. And that's kind of what the nature of this science funding in the Cold War was like. And so it imagined that everybody's equally threatened. But once you remove the idea of everybody being equally threatened in a society, right, then it's a different ballgame. So when we talk about medical conditions, of course, not everyone is equally threatened. Right? And that then determines the way the research goes, right, and what sorts of things that pharmaceutical companies are willing to fund. Right, because basically you want, you know, the ideal thing would be to have, to do research on ailments that affect a large number of rich people. Okay, and that explains a lot of how medical research works. What you don't want to do research on is on stuff that only affects poor people who can't pay. Okay, and this is a, you know, a lot of the issues about, you know, so if you look at the development of research concerning AIDS, right, the thing, you know, homosexual rights, the whole homosexual movement has been very strong in pushing biomedical companies and scientific research in the direction of developing some sort of cure for AIDS. Okay. But of course, those people, and you imagine these people living in San Francisco or London or whatever, right, very wealthy, you know, literate people who know how to organize and mobilize and use computers and contact their MPs and so forth, right? That's just the tip of the iceberg of all the people who get AIDS, right? There's all these people in Africa who get AIDS. Okay, and in Southern Africa, the estimates are that whatever 15 to 25% of the male population has it. Okay, now the question is, how do you get those drugs, right, and that research down there? Because the market isn't great. There are not that many paying customers. There are a lot of people, but they don't have a lot of money. So the economics isn't good for this. And so you have to get all kinds of, this is where you have to start to get, you know, pressure, you know, from the United Nations, from NGOs, on these companies to come up with some sort of settlement whereby they will sell these drugs at cheap prices so that people can buy them. Okay, so the issue with AIDS, in a way, indicates, you know, the way in which AIDS research works and the way in which the products and the fruits of that research get distributed to people around the world, right, illustrates the kind of problem that we're in now, given that science has opened up much more to market conditions. Now, let's step back for a minute. What, you know, how do you want to characterize what's going on here? right? And as sociologists, this is something we spend a lot of time doing in the senses of, we're sort of masters of the art of conceptual capture, right? We like to label things, right? Things are happening, we have to slap a label on it, right? Well, what are you going to call this? Okay? And this is where a term like postmodern comes in. All right? Because one of the things that it involves, now, when we say postmodern, it's in a way frustratingly, but also usefully ambiguous term. Okay. Is there anyone who hasn't really run across this term in a sociology course? No. Okay. See, this is quite interesting. Because this is one of the terms that when I was a student in your position 30 years ago did not exist. Okay, I think this is a very important sort of generational thing. And I think a lot of people's attitudes toward the postmodern has a lot to do with that. Okay, so this is definitely a generational difference thing. This is something that is about now, but no one would have said 30 years ago. The word didn't really exist. Okay, now, we got post and modern here, right? And the question is going to be what the post means. Now, the modern part is not too hard to figure out. And in the case of science, this has to do with the idea that, you know, science is the motor of social progress, that it has this kind of unified, forward-looking direction, right? That the state, in a way, is the great supporter of science, right? And will distribute the benefits to the people. And that you can't have too much science, right? Science is the solution to all your problems. It will dispel all the ignorance, myths of the past, right? And it'll enable us to lead, you know, really flourishing, rational, progressive lives. Okay? Now, this way of thinking about the role of science, right, as this kind of positively propelling force, I think, generally speaking, is something that you would say on the political spectrum is common to the liberal to left. Conservatives have always had rather kind of checkered, mixed views about science from the very beginning. And in a sense, a lot of the conservative problems with science aren't so different from a lot of the issues the postmodernists raise up. Okay? So there is a sense in which there are two ways, you might say, of looking at postmodernism, and both of them are kind of right. One is to say, okay, postmodernism is a kind of radical break with the modern that moves it into this whole different space. And postmodernists like to see themselves that way. And there's some truth to that. But there are other aspects of postmodernism that make it look like it's a return to the pre-modern, to the more conservative way of looking at things. One of the things that conservatism historically has always been very big on is the idea of the importance of traditions, of local culture, okay, of respecting things that have been around for a long time, and not just transforming them because you've got some theory or plan or reason. Okay? Now, postmodernism also harks to this. Okay, so if you think about multiculturalism, which we'll look at a little bit next week, okay, and this whole idea that you got to respect the ethnic, religious identities of people, think about the controversy that the Archbishop of Canterbury recently got himself into, right, you think about multiculturalism, okay, multiculturalism resonates a lot with very traditional conservative ideas, okay, which is to kind of respect people, you know, in terms of where they're coming from, right, in terms of their cultures and things like that. And so a typical conservative response to the advance of science in the 19th and even 20th centuries was to say, look, you're destroying a lot of what makes human beings what they are, which isn't just whether they can calculate efficiently and whether they can move things quickly and, you know, all the stuff that science enables us to do, whether we live longer even, but rather, what are our values? Where do our values come from? And they historically do come from your family and your religion and your culture and all these more local kinds of things. Okay? Now, multiculturalism is telling you that too. Okay. I think an interesting place to see this whole issue about what postmodernism and modernism means is in the case of contemporary Turkey. Anyone here from Turkey? Turkey is a very interesting country to look at in this respect, okay? Because Turkey, as you know, is a Muslim country, all right? But starting in the 1920s, when the Ottoman Empire, which was the largest Muslim empire in the world at the time, got broken up, Turkey formed as a secular republic, okay? And it was a secular republic in a very strong sense, in the way that France became a secular republic in 1870. In France, which was, you know, a historically Catholic country, right, the church ran all the schools and everything, in 1870, France becomes completely secular, removes the church's authority over all the schools, takes them over, bans religion from all kinds of forms of public expression, and in fact creates a kind of religion of the secular. So in other words, you start to get this whole business of nationhood, nationalism, in a very strong sense, right, a sort of secular version of the religion, but doesn't have any reference to Catholicism, formally speaking. Okay? And so then there becomes this whole business about, you know, pledging loyalty to that entity, that non-religious entity. Well, the same thing happened to Turkey, and it was modeled on the French situation. Kemal Atatürk, the founding president of the country, basically operated as a dictator for about 15 years, you get everything transformed. So, for example, Arabic gets thrown out, and everything gets written in the sort of Romantic script, okay? That's an interesting point. So you have a Muslim country, right, which doesn't use Arabic, even though they had before. You have completely secular schools and all the rest of it. So it's a certain secular country where most of the people are Muslim. In that respect, it's kind of like the way European countries are, for the most part. It's very similar that way. But now, right, there's been the rise of this party called the AKP, which now runs the country, which has a very interesting kind of role, because it is an Islamic party officially, but it's also a very pro-capitalist party, okay? And it's very much for free trade and opening the doors and all the rest of it, while trying to sort of loosen the restrictions on religious expression. So in other words, you know, allowing women to wear the headscarf and so forth in schools, which is currently banned, allowing all that kind of stuff to happen. And in that context, the modernist secular state of Turkey is seen as this kind of authoritarian, trying not to be open-minded to, you know, the religion of the people, seeing as kind of bigoted against views people already have. Okay, so in other words, the kind of modernist move that was initially made to make Turkey a nation state is being seen as a kind of regressive thing, even though it was progressive back in the 1920s. And what you have now is this reinvention of a kind of religious orientation that is presented as progressive and pluralistic. And that's kind of a postmodern move for you, okay, where you get a reappropriation of something that in the past would have been seen as conservative, but now being seen as progressive. And in general, the phenomenon of multiculturalism can largely be understood this way. Okay. Now the question is, why do people want to be against the modern? Right? Because that's an interesting question in itself, right? Why do we need a postmodern? Why can't we stay with modern? Okay. Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. And the one that I've been highlighting so far is basically that the need for consolidating people into one way of seeing things, one secular worldview, right, one scientific worldview, the need for that disappears, right? The Cold War is over. People don't have to gather together and concentrate their resources and centralize so much, right? That in a sense, once that common threat is removed, then people wonder, why am I supporting this state? You know, this secular state. You know, the secular state that prevents me from asserting things that I consider very close to my identity, like, for example, my religion or my ethnic views or whatever. And that's the question, right? Also, the state in this very modernized, concentrated way costs a lot of money, which means taxing people. And so there's this economic issue here, too. During the Cold War, all of the modern states, whether we're talking about the ones who were on the side of the U.S., or the ones that were on the side of the USSR, they all incurred massive budget deficits. And in fact, most of them have had to live with budget deficits for the last 20 years or more. Okay? And that typically means more taxes, but that's very unpopular. So what do you do when you're in the crunch? Well, if you're a politician, what you do is you say, we do less. The state does less. We devolve responsibility for things to the so-called private sector. And the private sector, then, is where the various religious ethnic influences can be felt more directly, because it means you're making things more local. Okay? So those economic pressures, as well, tend to move things in a postmodern direction. Okay? And I think one of the ways you see this is, when you ask people it's really striking in this country, right, the problems of trying to establish a basis for patriotism in this country. It's not a problem in the United States, because the United States is in endless wars. And if you're always in war, there's always going to be a reason for supporting the state in a strong way. And the whole idea of people volunteering to go into the military and so forth is a very regular part of the American scene. Okay? America's had to draft people to go to Vietnam, but regularly speaking, people are always going into the military in the United States voluntarily. Okay? Whereas in this country, it's a big problem. It's a big problem throughout Europe. Okay? And unless you have a kind of mandatory national service, right, typically it's very hard for the armed forces to replenish their ranks, because there isn't a very strong sense of patriotism among people, right? So they don't identify with this state. They identify more with their local communities or whatever. Okay? All of that speaks to postmodernism. Right, in a sense, the state is artificial. This whole centralized way of thinking about society, where somehow we're all part of this one unit, that this is something that has to be imposed on us, but it's not something that we're naturally, kind of gravitate toward. Now, see, this puts educational systems and universities in a particularly difficult position, right? Because historically, the reason why educational systems, especially universities, have grown is basically as vehicles for manufacturing citizens. That is to say, all of you people from all your diverse backgrounds, you come into this classroom and we turn you into something kind of unified, or at least a little more unified than you were before you got here. Okay, and how do you do that? Well, you will all learn the same things, right? And in some sense, learning these things, right, matters in terms of making your way forward in life. Because in some sense we judge you or examine you or evaluate you in terms of your knowledge of these things we teach you here. Okay? Now the relationship is quite vague in terms of exactly what is the relationship between anything you learn in this class and anything that matters in terms of how you advance in life, but there is some kind of relation, at least at the level of language, in the ability to understand things and be able to, interact in certain ways, right, that gets you beyond whatever parochial origins you have in your village or town or whatever. Okay? So for example, historically, one of the things that education did very strongly, doesn't do that so much anymore, but was very concerned with teaching things like rhetoric and public speaking, so that you're able to address an audience and people can't tell where you're from. Right? Because one of the great modes of discrimination, especially in this country, much more so than other countries, is the way you talk. Right? I mean, where you talk regionally, class-wise, all these things can immediately, you open your mouth, you speak for 30 seconds, and we immediately know where to put you in the great scheme of things. Now, that's a real disadvantage if you're supposed to be living in a unified society where everybody's supposed to be on the same team. Okay? So one of the things that education traditionally did was to launder out your cultural background. Right? So you didn't seem so obviously where you came from. Okay? We don't do that so much anymore. In fact, that's even frowned upon to do that. To say like, I don't like, your accent. I can't make sense of what you're saying. That's actually seen as somehow offending people's cultural rights. Okay? But that's also part of the postmodernism, is the tolerance of the difference in the classroom. Okay? And the degree to which the curriculum itself itself has become diversified. So it's not even, we give you more and more choice in the curriculum as time goes on, right? So there's a sense in which supposedly we put you in this one university because we're trying to teach you something that's supposed to enable you all to move as a common force, but in fact we allow you lots of choice, so that in principle we're going to get to a point where everybody could tailor make their curricula to however they feel like it. Individualized. That kind of defeats the purpose of having you all together in the first place. But that's kind of where we're going, and that's part of the postmodernization too. Okay? So all of these trends of postmodernization, right, which, they're happening at many different levels. Now the question here is, how does it get justified? Right? I may have already given you a kind of historical justification in terms of the recent past with the end of the Cold War. But there are other kinds of justifications, and you may have run across some of them. I mean, the man who put postmodernism on the map as a kind of intellectual idea, the kind of thing that social theorists spend their lives worrying about, was this man Lyotard. Have people run across him? How many people have run across Lyotard? Okay. Lyotard wrote this report. I mean, this is interesting how this idea came about. He wrote this report in 1979 called The Postmodern Condition. Okay. And the report was translated to English about 5 years later. Now, the interesting thing about this book is that it was actually a report that was written to the Higher Education Funding Council of Quebec, right, the French-speaking province in Canada. That's sort of the occasion on which this was written. So it's if you've ever seen The Postmodern Condition, I recommend you read it. It's an interesting book. It's very small. It's a report. It's like, the kind of thing you would do for a grant, okay? And it was this, they asked him to talk about the state of knowledge. And so this is 1979. And the point that Lyotard brings out, which is what he meant by postmodern, was the idea that, in fact, if we talk about where knowledge comes from, okay, that the traditional way of thinking about how knowledge develops is just false. And what Lyotard is particularly criticizing is the idea that universities are the places where knowledge comes from. Okay, so again, remember what I was saying about the universities before, right? The universities, to a large extent in the modern era, are created as these vehicles, right, for manufacturing citizens, turning all you people from your different backgrounds into citizens, right? And it's also seen as the place where the knowledge is produced, right? So, as it were, we bring all these students together to get to the point, right, where the knowledge actually is happening, right? So you get this impression that we're all doing research, that we're all on the cutting edge here, and we're giving you some kind of insight as to, all these new ideas and discoveries and so forth that you can then take forward. That is the idea of what a university is supposed to be. Humboldt, all these people I talked about earlier in the course, certainly had this kind of idea of university in mind. Lyotard says a total myth. It's a total myth from a historical standpoint. That, in fact, if you look at where the important knowledge comes from, especially in the 20th century, and he's thinking about the 20th century, okay, that most of it doesn't come from the universities, right? Most of it comes from outside the universities. In fact, in lots of different areas, and many of them corporate settings. And so what is he thinking about? Well, what he's thinking about is the fact that most of the breakthroughs in knowledge that have had a lot of important influence in transforming the infrastructure of our societies have been interdisciplinary, right? Interdisciplinary research. So if we're thinking about things, for example, like, take molecular biology. Molecular biology, which is very much behind the sort of biomedical sort of vanguard that we see going on in science today. It very much underwrites biotechnology, the pharmaceuticals, all the rest of it. Molecular biology is a field that basically got manufactured by the Rockefeller Foundation in the 1930s and 40s, right, putting money into labs to encourage physicists to move into biology. Because if you know, molecular biology is basically treating microscopic forms of life like physical chemical systems. And that's how you get DNA, is by thinking about the biology that way. Darwin didn't think about life that way, right? Darwin's thinking about animals living in environments and stuff like that. But if you want to come up with something like DNA, you've got to think about, you've got to forget about animals as whole beings, then you have to start chopping them up, looking at the cells, and thinking of them as physical chemical systems. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, you bring in people who actually know some physics and chemistry. And this actually required some movement of money and personnel from one place to another. The universities weren't doing that themselves. Why not? Because universities are in the business of reproducing disciplines, right? So, when we teach you sociology, right, we're expecting that you learn sociological knowledge. And if you're really interested, what happens? You want to become a sociologist. And what do you want to do when you become a sociologist? More of the same. Right? More, that's pretty much the story. I mean, this is what Lyotard's telling us, right? He's right. He's right. From a standpoint of how universities are organized, with a sort of disciplinary structure, that basically you come in, you study a discipline, you master the discipline, you may apply it outside the university, but if you stay in the university, you're just going to reproduce the discipline. That's the story. So then how does the stuff that's interdisciplinary happen? Right? You need some kind of external incentive, some kind of external motivation. And so the Rockefeller Foundation, which as you know is this kind of corporate benefit, you know, Rockefeller, Standard Oil, big oil mogul from the late 19th, early 20th century. He established these philanthropic agencies that threw money at everything in the 20th century. That's the Rockefeller Foundation. And so one of the things that they were very interested in, because you got to think about these. This is typically how philanthropic organizations operate, at least in the old days. Nowadays, of course, everything's been completely sanitized and laundered, so you don't see these roots anymore. But typically the idea was, look, if I'm running a major multinational corporation, I want my workers to be well-behaved, well-fed, healthy, lasting a long time. So I got to understand how human beings work, right? I got to figure out how they work and perhaps make them better so they can, you know, produce things more effectively. That's my job, you know. And so if I'm thinking about a long-term horizon for my corporation, I've got a lot of interest in putting money into research that's going to enhance human beings in various ways. So, the idea about putting money into molecular biology was that if we actually got to kind of the root causes of what makes life work, right, we might be able to do stuff like fiddle with genes, just like we are doing now, right? So that we can maybe prevent certain diseases from happening or, you know, compensating for certain diseases when they arise and so forth. That if we actually get to the nitty-gritty levels of life, that we might be able to mess around and produce more robust people. That's the idea, right? And these corporate guys, you know, they think, you know, long-term strategy, throw some money at this stuff and see what happens. And this is what philanthropic agencies are about, right? They typically are based on a sort of corporate mentality, but there's a long-term funding thing. Right? So you've got to imagine, right? Rockefeller has a short-term strategy, which is to say, keep the factories working, make sure there's enough equipment, make sure the workers are paid enough so they come back to work the next day. That's a short-term strategy. The long-term strategy is this foundation work where you're putting money into science, right, to improve the workers of tomorrow. Not the ones you've got now, but the ones you will have in the future, assuming your corporation is still around. Okay? And so that's why all these foundations put all this money into science. But what that means, typically, another example with regard to the rise of computer science and artificial intelligence research and all that kind of stuff that we see today, Bell Laboratories, right? Bell, the telephone company, right, interested in the future of communications. They established their lab, same deal, take people from the universities who are working in one subject or multiple subjects and put them in a setting where they can work together and come up with this stuff, the discoveries from which will transcend existing disciplinary boundaries. And so Lyotard knows all this, right? Lyotard sees this. And he said, and you know, and a lot of it, and you know, to a large extent, a lot of it's happening in the United States. Though some of it happens in Britain, too. I'll give you a good example. Molecular Biology Laboratory in Cambridge, interesting point, where is it? It is not on the main campus. It's on the outskirts of town. And it's privately funded. Okay, and the biology department at Cambridge, even to this day, is dominated by natural historians.
Okay, in other words, it's dominated by people trained kind of like Darwin who study animals in nature. But the molecular biologists are off campus. Okay, so that kind of historical division is still marked in the way in which the university organizes its research in a place like Cambridge. And Cambridge was one of the beneficiaries of the Rockefeller money in the 1930s and 40s. Okay, and in fact, it was through that Rockefeller money that Watson and Crick had the time to be able to do the stuff that led to DNA. Okay? So, now Leotard knows all this, and you'll see that it's in this text. Okay, he knows all this, and so his conclusion is, well, it doesn't look like universities are particularly progressive places. Okay? That in fact people have to escape the university, they have to go elsewhere, right, in order to develop things. And that in fact what universities do is merely capture the stuff. So he presents universities in a very negative light. Universities are basically, they're a bit like the way Marx presents capitalists or maybe even the landholders in his writing. Namely, people who don't do any productive labor. Universities don't do any productive labor, but they're in the role of legitimating the stuff. Right? So in other words, all this stuff is happening off the campus, right, by people who maybe, you know, who may or may not have PhDs, right, and they're doing all this interesting stuff, but whether it gets to count as science will depend on whether it gets into anybody's curriculum or whether it gets published in some peer-reviewed journal that is run by an academic. Okay, so in other words, what the universities control are the modes of legitimation, but that's all they control. They don't control the means of production when it comes to knowledge. This is Lyotard's point. And so Lyotard thinks that, in fact, this whole idea that the modern era has been promoting, that, you know, you build more universities, you put more people into them, they produce more knowledge, and society becomes more progressive, is a complete myth. That, in fact, knowledge comes from many disparate locations, and that, in fact, the universities and the official state licensed authorities are in fact obstacles to the new knowledge. There usually has to be a fight in order to get it into the universities. Okay, and that's true. It's certainly historically true. So Lyotard's view then is that we really need to think about the production of knowledge as a much more fragmentary, diversified kind of thing that doesn't necessarily lead in any particular direction. There's no goal or progress or anything of that sort, but rather has, you know, adapts to its circumstances. Right? So in a sense, he opens the door to a kind of market-based interpretation of what knowledge can be. If you haven't read Lyotard's book, it's worth reading. I mean, the person who he really is taking aim at here is Habermas. Because Habermas, in a way, for him, represents, you know, kind of the myth of the university embodied. There's that kind of rivalry going on there. Okay, so that's Lyotard. But there are other ways in which postmodernism gets raised. Lyotard's view, if you look at what Lyotard's view amounts to, it amounts to saying that basically the modern condition's view of itself is false. Right? In other words, all this talk that, you know, there is this kind of single trajectory of science that's embodied in academic research and that it makes society more progressive, that story is false. That is Lyotard's point. And so postmodernism is getting beyond that story. And you may know, you know, a lot of the discourse that's associated with postmodernism is about being against grand narratives, against meta-narratives, right? You may have run into this way of speaking. I hope this is not completely unknown to you. This is Lyotard, right? Lyotard is the man who says, look, that modernity is a grand narrative and it's false. Okay, and there is no grand narrative to be had. It's just a lot of these little narratives about how knowledge develops in various places. are themselves things that are manufactured by universities to legitimate themselves. That's the idea. Okay? So that's Lyotard's view on the postmodern. But that's not the only view around. Okay? There are a couple of others. And the other two basically believe that modernity has happened. So they don't deny what Lyotard denies, that they accept that it happened. But in one case, modernity has run its course. It's kind of finished. And in the other case, modernity has self-destructed. So it's quite opposite kind of diagnoses here, right? And so postmodern can be either of those two. So let's look at the one where it self-destructs, okay? Now this view of that, you know, we get into the postmodern condition when modernity self-destructs. What does this mean? Well, a lot has to do with the idea that if you take seriously that modernity is about applying knowledge and reason to all aspects of human affairs, including those aspects that were traditionally the sort of domain of family, religion, values, stuff of that kind, that what you do is you end up just undermining every fundamental belief that people have. Right? Every foundation gets undermined. So you look at, you know, often when people want to say, when does modernity begin? In philosophy, at least, we talk about René Descartes, right, who's writing in 1637, and he's the guy who says, cogito ergo sum. You might have run across that on a t-shirt. That means, I think, therefore I am. Okay? And the idea being here, Descartes basically strips away everything, right, that people have taken for granted as knowledge because it can be questioned. And what reason does is question, right? Reason is critical. Reason wants to get behind the appearances. That's what the whole modern thing's about, you know. We're not going to take things for granted. We want good reason, so we're getting behind everything. And Descartes says, where do you end this? You end it by not being able to deny yourself your own existence, because you're the one going through all this reason. You know, I think, therefore, I am. So Descartes solved the problem to his satisfaction. And in a sense, that's always been kind of the ultimate kind of resting point, you might say. When modernists have been in doubt, they always trust their powers of reason, their own powers of reason. But really now, can we trust our own powers of reason? And as you know, in the 20th century, if you think about the wars, the world wars, 1 and 2, okay, you start to get a lot of doubts about whether you can trust people's powers of reasoning. I mean, because already after World War I, right, World War I, Germany's defeated, but Germany is the leading scientific power in the world in World War I. And it basically said, and it was very belligerent, it kind of started the war, and it said, look, we're the major scientific power, we've got all the advanced technology and everything behind us. We're going to win this war. Science prevailed. They lost. This led to an enormous sort of feeling of doubt, self-criticism, and that, my God, you know, if you just let reason follow its natural conclusion, you end up getting disaster, that people have to realize their limits. And so in the 1920s, you start to get a kind of revival of irrationalism in various ways, including a revival of religion, and even, you know, what we call religious fundamentalism in Christianity, in a way, really takes off at this point. This idea that we human beings have to rediscover their limits as creatures, because if we think that we are, in a sense, just gods, without powers of reasoning, we will end up destroying ourselves and the planet. Okay? And this was a fueling to religion already in the 1920s. Okay. And of course, World War II, even bigger disaster of the same kind, right? And you know maybe about the Frankfurt School, Horkheimer and Adorno, the critique of instrumental reason. When we hear about this instrumental reason, that's what we're talking about. Reason being used merely as a means, without thinking about what is the end to which it's being used, just sort of applying it mindlessly. Okay? So
So if you start to have this idea, hey, I have this idea of a perfect society. It will have perfect people. But hey, the people we've got lying around ain't so perfect. Let's get rid of half of them. Right? I mean, this is where you end up. What's stopping you from going down that route? So in a sense, modernity self-destructs because it is too wedded to an idea of reason that's just sort of unleashed and allowed to follow its course without any kind of sense of self-control. And where would the self-control come from? The self-control would come from the things that the conservatives typically harped on. Values, religion, family, dignity, sanctity, all these things. Okay? Now the problem, of course, with people like the Frankfurt School and most of these kinds of postmodern style critics of modernity is they don't actually believe in any of this religious stuff, right? They don't actually believe in any of the conservative stuff. So in that sense, they're sort of stuck in a weird kind of nihilism, right? Because in a sense, they sort of believe, yes, the conservatives have diagnosed the problem exactly right, namely if you let reason just kind of run its course and dictate everything you do, then you'll end up self-destructing. But the problem is, do we have any reason, on the other hand, to accept religion, value, or the families, or anything else as any good? Okay, so these guys typically end up in a kind of nihilistic, or you might say, politically suspended position. One of the things that's interesting about postmodernism as a kind of mode of being in the world is that postmodernists are forever ambivalent. You may have run across this word a lot, ambivalent. This is almost like a badge of honor for these people. Right? It's the idea that, I don't know, it could be anything. It may go anywhere. The world's a complicated place. Lots of things are happening. Right? Anything I do is an act of aggression. Right? I mean, and this is a very postmodern way. Michel Foucault really exemplifies this. Okay, Foucault's manner of writing is very much like this. Where you're never quite sure, what does he think about what he's saying? He's kind of in this very suspended mode of fascination about everything. Okay? And this is very postmodern. And it's a kind of, self-depoliticization, right? Which comes about because you no longer believe in your own reason to lead you somewhere, but at the same time, you can't go back to the old values of the conservatives either. So you're sort of stuck. So postmodernism, in that sense, is kind of a stuck position. Now, of course, if you're an academic, it's a very convenient position to be in, I should say. And one of the reasons why most of the postmodernists in the world are in academia is because when we present stuff, of course, we're always giving you both sides of the issues. We're always giving you on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, right? And the point is that what that does, right, is, we're not expected to kind of give you a judgment about things. We just have to lay it all out. And that the postmodernists can do very, very well. And lay them all out equally. But of course, then you're sort of incapacitated at the end. Okay, and that's kind of a big problem. See, modernism, whatever else one wants to say about modernism, is modernism knew where it was going. It had a direction. It had a focus. It had a sense of what was progressive and what was regressive. Right? That was what it had going for it. It could take decisions. It knew what to do. Postmodernism may show all the flaws of modernism, but at the end of it, what are you left with? Okay? That's the problem. Okay, so there's that kind of critique of modernism. The other one, which I'll just mention briefly, is the idea that, in a sense, modernism does work, and we've reached it. Okay? And that there's a sense in which, I don't know how many of you have, you run across Francis Fukuyama. You ever heard of him? Francis Fukuyama is American conservative political theorist who wrote a book in 1992 called The End of History and the Last Man. And this is an allusion to Nietzsche, okay? And Nietzsche sort of speculates at one point about, well, supposing all this modernity stuff is right, and we end up getting to a point where we have evolved to our ultra-modern state, where we have reached the kind of peak of evolution that all these modernists are talking about, where we're maximally rational, we've got it all under control, we control nature, we control ourselves, we can live as long as we want and do what we want, we've got all the laws of science figured out. Suppose we reach that point, is what Nietzsche asks, right? What would the last man want to do? What would that person want to do who got to that point?
And Nietzsche said, this guy would have nothing to do. He'd just kill himself. Right?
And this is kind of the challenge, right? I mean, you know, in other words, because Nietzsche was very impressed by, to a certain extent, right? Nietzsche died in 1900, so Nietzsche died before the Great Wars, okay? But Nietzsche, you know, he's kind of impressed. Oh, well, there's a lot of modernization going on here. Things are really moving forward. People say we're making progress. Okay, what happens if we reach it? What happens if we reach the end point? What's there to live for? Okay? How many of you have ever seen the film Clockwork Orange? Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that film, okay, the sort of nihilism that's displayed by the kids in the film, in a way, Kubrick was partly motivated by this kind of Nietzschean issue. Okay, namely, because right, Clockwork Orange takes place in the context of some kind of really maxed out version of a welfare state, right? Where everything's under surveillance, where everything is medicalized, everything is watched, and there's a sense in which whatever destruction you cause, it gets remedied. Everything gets fixed, right? If you think about how the film ends, for example, right? They got him in the hospital, and they renovate him, and he's going to go back out again, and he's going to start causing mayhem. Okay? And that whole idea of things, you know, you reach a point where you have this ultra-rational kind of state where everything's under control. What do you do to express yourself under those circumstances? Well, you just cause random violence. Because you know whatever happens, they're just going to fix it up anyway. Okay? And so this is part of the sort of, you know, what Nietzsche was kind of worrying about, kind of the meaningless of life, you might say, that would result if actually modernity got what it wants. Right? So in other words, the postmodern is to say, you don't want modernity to get what it wants. It's not that it won't happen. It's not that, it'll self-destruct. But rather, you don't want it. You really don't want to get to that point that the modernists are talking about. It would make life meaningless. Okay.
That's the other critic of art that is destructive.
What do you mean?
I'm sorry, instead of caught a little bit lost.
Okay, the point here is, if you imagine that, if you actually imagine that modernity would work, okay, the kind of state you would be in, once it worked, wouldn't be worth living.
Okay.
Right? And the world of Clockwork Orange illustrates that, because in a sense, the world of Clockwork Orange is giving you a sense of what such a world looks like. What do you do for self-expression in a world where everything's fixed, everything's sorted, no matter what you do, it all gets remedied, right? Every violence you do is seen as a kind of medical problem that can be taken care of with a couple of drugs. What's the point then? Right? So the point is you don't want to get to that state. It's not that you can't get to it. It's not that it self-destructs, but you don't want to get there. Right? And that's kind of the Nietzschean kind of objection that somebody like Fukuyama tries to deal with, and which comes out, I think, in Clockwork Orange. And so that's another kind of postmodern sensibility, one that kind of, as it were, says, we don't want to be modern. We don't want that goal. Okay? So there are all these different senses, then, in which, you know, postmodernism can happen, right? The very first one I talked about was that basically modernity is just a myth. Knowledge doesn't work that way, science doesn't work that way. That was Lyotard. Then there's this idea that modernity self-destructs, that if you apply reason to itself, you only end up destroying yourself, right? And the whole experience of the two world wars and so forth, and the Frankfurt School's reaction, that kind of leads you down that route. But then there's this other one that I've just been mentioning, which has to do with basically taking modernity seriously, that it could actually get to its goal. Would you want to live in that kind of world that the modernists are talking about? And the suggestion is the answer would be no, that it would be meaningless. Okay, so these are all three different kind of ways in which you can kind of do the postmodern condition. All right? We'll stop here, and we shall move on next time.
Alex, have you read anything of Kate Dickinson?
Yeah, a little bit.
Because it does seem to go on, it does seem to take this whole idea of, you know, perfect, sort of, like, twist it, makes it.